among the Sabians of Arabia, who regarded the moon and not the sun as the visible symbol of the favorite object of their idolatry. The same period was observed as the birth festival. Thus we read in Stanley's Sabian Philosophy, quote, on the 24th of the 10th month, that is December, according to our reckoning, the Arabians celebrated the birthday of the Lord, that is, of the moon. It's worthy of special note, too, that the Saxons regarded the sun as a female divinity and the moon as a male. So for them, it was the birthday of the Lord Moon and not of the sun that was celebrated by them on the 25th of December, even as the birthday of the same Lord Moon was observed by the Arabians on the 24th of December. Now the gestalt, abstract, connecting concept is that they tended to link their heathen philosophy to the creation. As clearly stated by Paul, they began to worship the creature rather than the creator. And as the Babylonians linked Nimrod and Tammuz to the sun, the Arabians and some of the Saxons linked it to the moon. In both cases, projection of a heathen deity to identity with a celestial body. At Rome, the feast was called the Feast of Saturn, and the mode in which it was celebrated there showed whence it had been derived. The feast, as regulated by Caligula, lasted 5 days. Loose reins were given to drunkenness and revelry. Slaves had a temporary emancipation and used all manner of freedom with their masters. This was precisely the way in which, according to Berosus, the drunken festival of the month Thebeth, answering to our December, in other words, the festival of Bacchus, was celebrated in Babylon. It was the custom, says he, during the 5 days it lasted, for masters to be in subjection to their servants, and one of them ruled the house, clothed in a purple garment like a king. This purple-robed servant was called Soganes, the man of sport and wantonness, and answered exactly to the lord of misrule that in the Dark Ages was chosen in all Roman Catholic countries to head the revels of Christmas. The wassailing bowl of Christmas had its precise counterpart in the drunken festival of Babylon, and many of the other observances still kept up among ourselves at Christmas came from the very same quarter. The candles in some parts of England lighted on Christmas Eve, used so long as the festive season lasts, were equally lighted by the pagans on the eve of the festival of the Babylonian god to do honor to him. For it was one of the distinguishing peculiarities of his worship to have lighted wax candles on his altars. The Christmas tree, now so common among us, was equally common in pagan Rome and pagan Egypt. In Egypt, that tree was the palm tree. In Rome, it was the fir. The palm tree denoting the pagan Messiah as Baal Tamar, the fir referring to him as Baal Berith. The mother of Adonis, the sun god, equivalent to Tammuz, and great mediatorial divinity, was mystically said to have been changed into a tree, and when in that state to have brought forth her divine son. If the mother was a tree, the son must have been recognized as the man of the branch. And this entirely accounts for the putting of the Yule log into the fire on Christmas Eve, and the appearance of the Christmas tree the next morning. Azirashta, quote, the seed of the woman, which name also signified Ignigena, or born of the fire. He has to enter the fire on Mother Night, that he may be born the next day out of it as the branch of God, or the tree that brings all divine gifts to men. But why, it may be asked, does he enter the fire under the symbol of a log? To understand this, it must be remembered that the divine child born at the winter solstice of these heathen religions was born as a new incarnation of the great god Nimrod, Tammuz, after that god had been cut in pieces, in the Egyptian legends particularly, on purpose to revenge his death upon his murderers. Now the great god cut off in the midst of his power, cut in pieces, and cut off in his strength and glory, was symbolized as a huge tree, stripped of all its branches and cut down almost to the ground. But the great serpent, the symbol of the life restoring, Asclepius, and this is why you see this symbol so often. The great serpent, the symbol of the life restoring, Asclepius, twists itself around the dead stock, and lo, at its side, up sprouts a young tree, a tree of an entirely different kind that is destined never to be cut down by hostile power, even the palm tree, the well-known symbol of victory. The Christmas tree, as has been stated, was generally at Rome a different tree, the fir, but the very same idea, as was implied in the palm tree, was implied in the Christmas fir. For that covertly symbolized the newborn god as Baal Berith. Lord of the covenant. One letter, if you know the etymology and the language, changed Berith, B-E-R-E-T-H, to B-E-R-I-T-H, Lord of the fir tree becomes Lord of the covenant. And thus shadowed forth the perpetuity and everlasting nature of his power in this heathen religion, now that after having fallen before his enemies, he has risen triumphantly over them all. Therefore, the 25th of December, the day that was observed at Rome as the day when the victorious God reappeared on earth and the sun started his march across the heavens and the days began to lengthen, was held at the Natalis Invicti Solis, the birthday of the unconquered sun. Now the Yule log is the dead stock of Nimrod, deified as the sun god but cut down by his enemies. The Christmas tree is Nimrod, reincarnated, the slain god come to life again. In the light reflected by this record on customs that still linger among us, the origin of which has been lost in the midst of traditions, let the reader look at the singular practice still kept up in the South on Christmas Eve of kissing under the mistletoe bough. Now we're to another subject, kissing under the mistletoe. The New Testament says, greet one another with a holy kiss, not a holly kiss. Kissing under the mistletoe, that marvelous Christian practice. Now this gets laboriously repetitive after a while, though little details are inserted in each record different than the others. How can anybody not be convinced of the origin of this December 25th festival? Now I'm not quarreling with the festival. I think it's a lot of fun. I'm not suggesting that you stop putting a log on the fire, decorating a Christmas tree, or eating a Christmas goose. Don't go as far as Osiris, and limit your satisfaction to a large goose. Just don't teach it as Christian. Quit feeling guilty about putting Christ into Christmas. He was born in the fall. And I repeat what I said earlier. If you're gonna keep a religious festival, keep one that has genuine significance and meaning today at this time of year. Hanukkah, and I'm not a Jew, but I recognize the importance of the kind of thing that Mordecai and Esther did to preserve religious freedom. And I tip my hat when the Feast of Purim comes along. And Hanukkah celebrates the rebellion of the Maccabees against the oppressive attempt of the Seleucid king Antiochus to declare himself Epiphanes, God manifest, and force a worship of the supremacy or a recognition of the supremacy of government even over their religious faith. That's the meaning of Hanukkah. So if you want to get religious, keep Hanukkah. Now, those that try to forget the real meaning of Hanukkah among the Jews, I think sort of cheapen it into a Christmassy kind of festival of lights, and they in turn have to watch they don't get infected with Babylonian practices, because the festival of lights comes from the restoration of the temple worship after the rebellion against the Seleucid oppressor Antiochus Epiphanes. But there's a religious festival with some significance and meaning that endures today. Christ was born in the fall, and you're better off to remember it as we did around the Feast of the Tabernacles time. Just have a party and go to the ball games and educate your kids on the power of heathen pagan worship and all these snide, smart-alecky news people that act like a faith in Jesus Christ as the Son of God and the resurrection is something for less than intellectuals to do. Just sit and smile as you watch them go through their number out of ignorance. They're trying to sound Christianized the few days around Christmas, too ignorant to know the origin of the traditions. I just threw that in free. Doesn't the news media make you want to puke?
Yes, sir.
I seem to remember a few years ago when Ronald Reagan did not want to have a summit or go anywhere to talk to Gorbachev, because he said he didn't see anything significant that would come out of it. And the news media blasted him for weeks for not carrying on dialogue. How important it was to talk just to be talking, rather than positioning for shooting. Now, the most significant talking that's been done with the Soviet Union since the Second World War has gone on for 3 days. And Reagan is right. First time ever, an absolute reduction in even one nuclear piece of weaponry. Rather than trying to put a ceiling on more, an actual reduction. First time in 45 years. There has been an allowance for the Soviet Union of inspection within their territories. Surprise. And or consistent teams of inspectors. the signing by the two heads of state, a meeting with Senate leaders, where all the news media can do is characterize it as a PR coup for selfish purposes by Gorbachev. Give him an A for that. He's the best they ever had. And total ignoring of the genuine effort to help Reagan job out, to persuade some cantankerous squirrels of the wisdom of ratifying this treaty. A genuine rapprochement of discussion on human rights issues without shouting insults and accusations resulting in a stalking out of the meeting or pounding on the table with a shoe. Man, I'm not on Gorbachev's side, but I give it to him. He hasn't met his match yet as a debater. I used to vote, write-in vote, every presidential election. Charles de Gaulle for president and Khrushchev for vice president. If he had a different philosophy, he'd be one hell of a president. A recognition, I think, for the first time in international discussions, instead of, you know, trying to do the cheap shot sensationalism that he's a charmer in public and behind closed doors goes hard as nails, why doesn't the news media consider the possibility he might be over their head? He is maybe the first genuine philosophic communistic socialist to lead that nation with a sense of idealism, which from his frame of reference justifies the philosophy and methodology that the end justifies the means, but one genuinely committed to ends larger than himself, and maybe the first since Lenin. Because that's the real tug of war. I am convinced that Gorbachev is the first Russian leader who genuinely believes that in an era of peace, socialism is the inevitable victor over the minds of men against capitalism. And that makes him, in a sense, though foolishly, I think, because I recognize the reality of sin, rooted in self-seeking, individualism. But I think he genuinely and truly philosophically believes that socialism is the destiny of mankind. And it will win. And that's pure Leninism. And that's what gives him his supreme confidence. I was disappointed to see a statesman I admire greatly say, sure, he's a charming personality, but so what? It's what's written in the documents that count. That sounded a little like sour grapes to me. From one who is seeing a personality accomplish
what his secret jetty service, and secretly arrived at agreements, could not accomplish. Treaties have been ignored by personality after personality. And what we are seeing is the power of a personality in strong leadership to shape history. But we watch the news media play down the results of this summit because they signed the most important part of it the first day. And probably stupidity magnified to the maximum has been heaped on the American public by the news media the last 3 days in creating the illusion that this summit is not significant, not as significant as the participants who know what's going on say. Reminds me of Moses and Joshua come down from Sinai. Joshua didn't know beans. He's halfway in between, like the news media, waiting out there with his cameras. Moses is up on the hill talking to God, so he knows everything. The people in the camp are partying, and they know what they're doing. And old Joshua, he'd been 40 days in the Never Never Land, waiting for him to come out so he can find out what's going on. He hears the noise from the camp. He says, it's war! He says, each one of his assessments are wrong. And Moses doesn't say a word. He knows what's going on. How can another summit between these two leaders build upon whatever rapport they established without a couple of days negotiation that achieves nothing definite as they take their measure on the next step, and each have agreed to try to continue? What did the news media expect? These two guys to come out I think they would rather have, it would have come out and made better news for them if they had come out and had a fist fight on the White House lawn. When they couldn't get one between Ronald and McKell, they tried to engineer one between Nancy and, what's her name, Risha? I agree with Nancy. I think she's sort of outmatched, but with Gorbachev's wife. I mean, Nancy's not in the habit of leading PhDs, professors in philosophy around every day. And you show me two women, wives of two leaders, that aren't concerned about their own image and role. So then they start saying on the news media, before she comes here again, she better take some lessons in American etiquette. From whom? The etiquette-driven news people? I mean, that goes beyond a pot calling a kettle black. It's a cesspool talking. And then the snide remarks like the Russians are counting the furs that she wears. Hell, that's one of their major products. They ought to give her a, they ought to do what the Queen of England did to the Beatles. Give her the equivalent of knighthood for displaying one of Russia's primary products. I have not seen so much stupidity from the news media. An expressionist agency known for setting new records in stupidity every day, but I mean, they jumped at least 3 years ahead of their normal schedule. They're always mad because they're not informed. Public's right to know. So this time they got informed as to what the major accomplishment of this summit would be before it happened, and they're mad because they knew before they got here. That's what they're complaining about? Nothing happened at this summit that we didn't know was going to happen. From the people who are mad because they don't get to know everything. I think they're all descendants of Osiris. The only thing that'll really satisfy them is a large goose. We have found from our study and Christmas research the only godlike trait that the news media has. I read to you the other night, Osiris, one of the Egyptian gods. The only thing that would satisfy him was a large goose. Now, the news media's magnified stupidity and identified themselves with their only brand of godliness. And with that, will you get on the telephone, please? I've been debunking some of the Christmas traditions, not to take the joy out of Christmas, just to make it intelligent. You wouldn't expect to find what I'm going to read in a book titled Stonehenge, A Closer Look by Bonnie Gaunt. But in the appendix, I'm reading. The date of Jesus' birth is generally accepted as 4 B.C. It may surprise some to find that no ancient historian, either ecclesiastical or secular, has recorded his birth as being in that year. Erroneous conclusions have been derived from certain statements of the Jewish historian Josephus, conclusions which his records do not warrant. Tertullian, one of the early Christian fathers, born about 160 A.D., stated that Augustus began to rule 41 years before the birth of Christ and died 15 years after that event. The date of Augustus' death is recorded as August 19th, 14 A.D. This would place the birth of Jesus at 2 B.C., you know, when you go from B.C. to A.D., there is no such thing as 0 B.C. or 0 A.D., so you subtract 1 year as you cross that so-called timeline. So if Tertullian is right, Jesus was born 2 B.C., In the same chapter, Tertullian stated that Jesus was born 28 years after the death of Cleopatra. Her death is recorded in history as occurring in 30 B.C. That again makes the birth of Jesus 2 B.C. Irenaeus, who was born about 100 years after Jesus, stated, quote, "Our Lord was born about the 41st year of the reign of Augustus." Again, since Augustus began his rulership in autumn of 43 B.C., it would place the birth of Jesus in the autumn of 2 B.C. Eusebius, who was termed the father of church history, wrote it was the 42nd year of the reign of Augustus, and the 28th from the subjection of Egypt on the death of Antony and Cleopatra in the course of Abia. I skipped a page. Didn't think that made sense. How did we get from Cleopatra to the course of Abia? It was the 42nd year of the reign of Augustus and 28th from the subjection of Egypt and the death of Antony and Cleopatra. The 42nd year of Augustus began in the autumn of 2 B.C., ended in the autumn of 1 B.C. The subjugation of Egypt and its incorporation into the Roman Empire occurred in the autumn of 30 B.C., therefore the 28th year from that time extended from the autumn of 3 B.C. to the autumn of 2 B.C. And it's the only possible date for the birth of Jesus that would conform to both of these requirements would be the autumn of 2 B.C. The common acceptance of the 4 B.C. date for the birth of Jesus is based on the oft-repeated statement that the death of Herod the Great was astronomically fixed by Josephus' record of an eclipse of the moon shortly before Herod died, and that that eclipse has been shown to have occurred on March 13th, 4 B.C. Even simple reasoning would show the impossibility of the birth of Jesus being in that year, for the Bible record not only shows his birth to be in the autumn, it shows additionally the considerable time elapsed between Jesus' birth and Herod's death, for the family fled to Egypt to escape Herod's edict that all boy babies should be killed. The lunar eclipse on March 13th, 4 B.C. was a small one, about four digits, and was visible in Israel from 2 a.m. until about 4 a.m. Coming at such an hour, it would be noticed by very few people. And Joseph, the Jewish historian, was not a recorder of eclipses. In all his writings, this is the only eclipse he ever mentioned. Lunar eclipses are common, often happening two or three times in a single year. It is hardly consistent, therefore, that Josephus would mention a small eclipse that happened in the early morning when everyone was asleep, and associate it with the burning of Matthias the day before. Speaking of the burning of Matthias by Herod, Josephus said, quote, "And on that very night there was an eclipse of the moon." To comply with the record of Josephus, it is reasonable that we look for an eclipse of the moon that was noticeable by its magnitude, not just four digits, and occurred in the early part of the night when people were up to see it. The correct eclipse to which Josephus referred would have to comply with the following requirements. One, an eclipse not less than 2 months but 6 months prior to a Passover. Two, be visible in the early part of the night at Jerusalem. Three, be of sufficient magnitude to be noticeable. An eclipse that complies perfectly with these requirements occurred on the evening of December 29th, 1 B.C., almost exactly 3 months before the Passover. It was an eclipse of about seven digits, thus more than half of the moon's orb was obscured. The moon was already in eclipse when it rose over Jerusalem and continued for about 2 hours, so that even children would have been able to see it before being put to bed. Now, Josephus was recording Jewish history, and he's writing about Herod burning Matthias. Since Herod died shortly after the burning of Matthias, but 2 months before the Passover, his death would have occurred sometime in January of 1 B.C. An ancient Jewish scroll, the Megillah Taneth, written during the lifetime of Jesus, gives the day and month of Herod's death as the first of Shebat. The first of Shebat is 1 B.C. by the Julian calendar and would be, or the first of Shebat in 1 B.C. by the Julian calendar would be January 14th. All the indicators show the error of traditions, attachment of a wrong date and a wrong eclipse to Josephus' reference, and that derived their wrongful dating of the birth of Jesus on or in 4 B.C. All the indicators as well as the testimony of the early fathers is 2 B.C. The world celebrates the birth of Jesus on December 25th, Christmas. The early Christian church did not celebrate his birth. Thus, the exact date was not preserved in tradition and festival observances. The first recorded mention of December 25th is in the calendar of Philocalus, 354 A.D., but as I showed you from the encyclopedia, actually practiced earlier. but only about 18 years earlier, still in the 4th century, which showed Jesus' birth to be Friday, December 25th, 1 A.D. This date is inconsistent with itself, for December 25th of that year was in fact a Sunday. The date of December 25th was officially proclaimed by the Church Fathers in 440 A.D. and was chosen because it Christianized the pagan festival of Saturnalia, literally the Sunday of Ruhalia. The winter solstice had meant the diminishing of the sun and its return again. Its central idea, the return of light, became the hope of the world and the birth of Jesus, the light of the world. The transition from paganism to Christianity was gradual but became generally accepted after the fall of Rome in 476 A.D. That's tradition. The exact date of Jesus' birth can, however, be determined from the available historical records. The information given in the Bible concerning the time of the conception of John the Baptist furnishes one method of calculation. Same thing I've been reading, just another source. Elizabeth, the mother of John, was cousin of Mary and the wife of a priest named Zacharias. Luke 1:5 states that Zacharias was a priest in the course of Abiah, Greek for Abijah. Verses 8 to 13 state that while Zacharias, quote, executed the priest's office before God in the order of his course, end quote, he was given the message that Elizabeth would have a son and that they should name him John. In verse 23 and 24, it's recorded, quote, and it came to pass that as soon as the days of his ministration were accomplished, he departed to his own house, end quote. The priests were divided into 24 classes. 1 Chronicles 24, 7 and 19 makes that clear, and each class officiated in the temple for 1 week. The courses of the priest changed duty with the change of the week, that is, from the end of the Sabbath at sundown until the next Sabbath. Both the Talmud and the historian Josephus state that the temple was destroyed by Titus on August 5th, 70 A.D., and that the first course of priests had just taken office. The previous evening was the end of the Sabbath. The course of Abiah, Greek for Abijah, was the 8th course. Thus, figuring backward, we're able to determine that Zacharias ended his course and came off duty on July 13, 3 B.C. and returned home to Elizabeth. The conception of John occurred that weekend, 13th to 14th. Now, the other writer took the courses from Josephus. That's why there's a two-day differential. This is a more accurate calculation because it takes multiple witnesses of the temple destruction and the record and the course of the priests, for that date was fixed in the minds of the Jews. And going backward, they come to the exact day, coming off duty July 13, 3 B.C., returned home to Elizabeth. The conception of John occurred that weekend, the 13th and 14th. The birth of John would take place 280 days later, not 3 months. I think I said 180 the other night in a misspoken word. Why didn't some of you women speak up? I can count money good. You got to be a woman to be intentionally correct on this. The birth of John would take place 280 days later, namely April 19th to 20th of 2 B.C., precisely at the Passover of that year. Elizabeth hid herself 5 months, and at the beginning of her 6th month, the angel Gabriel appeared to Mary, telling her of Elizabeth's condition. At the same time, Gabriel told Mary that she too would conceive and bear a son who would be called Jesus. Upon hearing this, Mary went with haste from Nazareth to Ein Kerem to visit Elizabeth, who was then in the first week of her 6th month. The time was the 4th week of December, 3 B.C. The 23rd of December of that year, according to the Julian calendar then in use, was precisely the winter solstice. If this were the date of the conception of Jesus, 280 days later would place the date of his birth at September 29th, 2 B.C. That is, first Tishri, the day of the Feast of the Trumpets, the Jewish New Year. Civil. This day had been set aside in the law of Moses. As a holy day. How fitting that Christ would be born on that day. More than that, it became another partial fulfillment of the substance that the shadow of the feast days had cast. On the day of the Feast of the Trumpets, twin trumpets blew as a symbol and type of redemption, approaching the Day of Atonement. And that's the tragedy of the pagan conquering of the church. It's robbed the church of the teaching, faith-inspiring teaching of God's control on history and his ability to make his set times happen. The day on which Jesus was born was not only the first day of the year, but also the first day of the 77th sabbatic cycle since the Jewish return from Babylonian captivity. From the reestablishment of the sabbatic cycles in Tishri 534 B.C. till the birth of Jesus in Tishri 2 B.C. was also a great paschal circle or paschal cycle of 532 years. A paschal cycle being the product of the Metonic cycle 19 and the solar cycle 28, 19 times 28, 532 years. Now, what's the significance of that? Am I boring you?
No,